Good morning. I'm Teresa. I'm an alcoholic. As Charlie said, we've known each other quite a number of years. We worked together in the intensive care unit. I was a nurse for 27 years, 21 of them in intensive care in Kentucky and the United States. As with many alcoholics, I have a history of difficulties in my life. I was an adopted child. I was adopted by a family who had two grown sons, and well, mostly grown. They were 17 and 18 years older than me. One grew up to be an alcoholic wife beater, as we call them in the United States. The other was a schizophrenic and a pedophile. And I was the victim of that for about 12 years before he was institutionalized in a state facility for his schizophrenia. And I basically left home at 17 and never returned. This, you know, was not really, believe it or not, the worst for me, in my mind, the worst thing that ever happened to me, because as I, you know, looked upon it and still do look upon it, that was their sin stance for in their life. And I figured I'd do enough sinning on my own, and I have. And I'll answer for those things. And they answered for them before God. They have all since passed. And that's okay. Once I left home, I went through college, you know, which I worked and paid for myself. And, you know, I was of above average intelligence, which was also a factor that made it very difficult for my family to know what to do with, because they were not that kind of family. They did not value education or anything like that. So they had no clue what to do with the child who started reading at three. And so once I left home, I never returned. And graduated college at 20, married for the first time at 23 to someone who I felt was my intellectual match. And he was a good man, and we wanted a family. Sadly, we were unable to have children, and I suffered four miscarriages in my first marriage, which was the greatest loss to me. And I did not deal with that well, nor did he. He was a cross-dresser, and his behavior progressed with each loss until by the end of our marriage, he absolutely wanted nothing to do with me. And ultimately, that ended our marriage. One of our losses was a son, and literally, when I lost him at 20 weeks, he left me in the hospital to, unfortunately, do the equivalent of give birth to the child. I had to arrange the funeral and go to the funeral alone. And luckily, a dear friend stepped in and took care of all the arrangements. And stood beside me, and literally to this day goes to the grave of that child that I have never been able to return to. That marriage ended in divorce, and I went on and ultimately met my second husband, who I am presently married to. God bless him. I don't know how he's stood through the last months, but he has. I moved to Northern Kentucky and met a very good and kind man who happened to be a rabid Manchester United fan, which leads me to the odd thing that we ended up getting married in Northern Ireland, or the north of Ireland, and we actually married in Helen's Bay. So I do have a connection with the Irish friends up there. I moved up here, built a new life, and began work as a nurse here in Northern Kentucky. And I was the primary breadwinner. My husband is almost 12 years older than I am. And we even started our marriage under a bit of a cloud. He had a significant heart condition, even knowing that when we married. But it happily took a turn for the better and was better for a significant number of years with treatment. And we had been very happy and went along. My drinking did not. I'd never really been a drinker. I mean, until probably 2015, my drinking consisted of a glass of wine two or three times a week. And then in 2016, our oldest daughter, since I had no children and he had four children, his oldest daughter, I had become very, very close to. She was the only child who, only person who ever called me mom and meant it. She and I had become extremely close. She developed bladder cancer. She was diagnosed the day after Mother's Day on May 9th. The bladder cancer was extremely aggressive. By June 28th, she died. It had spread through her entire body in that short a period of time. We had gone out on to see her on June 15th. And at that time, I realized how devastatingly aggressive it was. And she had been estranged from her own mother and had not even seen her by that time. She had made me her spokesperson. So I had to make the call to her mother to say, if you want to see your child before she dies, you need to get your butt out of here and see her. And I had to sit there in the waiting room on her father's 65th birthday while the doctors sat and explained to my husband and her partner that she was going to die in a matter of days, because I knew everything that they were going to say, every word. I knew all the horrible things that the diagnosis meant, because I had seen the scans. They had shown them to me. And I watched their world crumble. And I walked them through the process of her dying. And I got the family through it. And literally, when she died, I stepped back and I let everyone else take the lead. I stepped to the background as a good stepmother. And let her mother be the crying person. And I swallowed my grief and I did what I had to do and let everyone else do their thing. And I paid for her funeral and everything. And I came home and I drank a pint of bourbon afterwards. And that's probably the first time I had drunk a pint of bourbon in my life. But I grieved. I grieved terribly. And a year later, to the day from her death, my husband, we found out his heart was beginning to fail again, and that he was going to have valve replacement. And so we went through that surgery, and he had an extremely difficult recovery. He lost 25 pounds in 2 weeks. It was tough. And I was working all through this period of time and trying to take care of him and everything. But, you know, we got through it. And, you know, I think I was still grieving our daughter, and I was taking care of him, but still working, still going. And my drinking at that point in time had now gone to probably a glass of wine 4 or 5 times a week. I hadn't, you know, hadn't gone back to the bourbon other than that one day, but the wine had increased. And, you know, a year later, fell, broke my leg, had to be off for 3 months. You know, just silly, stressful events. And no, I hadn't been drinking when I fell and broke my leg. That was stressful. And it seemed, you know, it was one thing after another. And then we're getting into, you know, just more stress. We both started having little illnesses. He was hospitalized with some problems with kidney stones, and I had some illness as well that just wouldn't clear up. And we now think that possibly I had early COVID, because we had been in the Northwest, and this was in the late fall of 2019 by that time. And things started, then we entered into COVID times. And initially, our hospital was not the COVID hospital, but we got all the patients who were super sick, who had we had designated one hospital for COVID. And so we got all the heart attacks and the COPDers and the overdoses and people who were so desperately ill, and there was no place for them to go because one hospital completely was filled with COVID patients. And then there wasn't enough room for COVID patients in that hospital, so we started taking them. And then we helplessly watched night after night after night. And you would walk into work and when we walked in with COVID, that became the living nightmare. We would walk in the door and you'd walk past the room and you'd see a patient who wasn't vented on a ventilator the night before, and they were on a ventilator. And you knew that second they were going to die. And you'd go to the next room and you'd look at them and you'd go, no, they don't look good. They're going to die. They're going to be vented and they're going to die. And then you'd go to the next room or you'd get a patient. And the first thing you'd do when you get them and you'd look at them. And you just knew. You'd watch them deteriorate under your hands in minutes sometimes, or maybe hours. And at first, it was people who were, and I'm 62 years old, just for the record. At first, it was old people. And I say that, you know, older than me people, 60s, 70s. And then it was people my age, 70. 80 or 60, 50s. Then it was people are my stepchildren's age, 40s. Then it was 20s. But I would get a patient, and sometimes I would be in rooms for hours upon end in full isolation gear, which, you know, for the ordinary person, they don't really understand how miserable that experience is, to be in layers of plastic and stuff. But it's kind of a miserable physical experience, but it's a miserable emotional experience, especially when you're a person who's used to being able to touch their patient, to talk to their patient, to be able to have human contact with another person. I started my nursing career in hospice, so my goal as a nurse was always to give comfort, to make them know that they were cared for, that they were human, that they mattered, that they weren't just a thing hooked up to a machine. And with what we were doing then, we were just trying to keep an organism alive sometimes. And some of the things that we had to do to them just to try to keep that organism alive was pretty darn horrible. They had no possibility of seeing their loved ones. In many cases, I was the last face they ever saw, and they couldn't even really see my face. Sometimes, really all they saw, occasionally, was tears that would roll down my face. I had patients who were begging me, please don't let me die. And you would say, I'm going to take care of you. I'm going to take care of you. And in your gut, you knew the only thing you were going to take care of was their body once they passed away. I remember one particular evening, I got a gentleman in, a very sweet man. He was from originally from Germany, and he was quite in extremis, but he could still speak, and we were trying to talk, and he wanted to talk. He wanted someone there who could, I guess, remember him. And he was hoping somehow to get something out that I could tell his sons. And I'm trying to keep him calm as I'm doing everything I can for him. And he was talking about, he was from Leverkusen. And we were talking, and I was talking about football with him. And, ask him if he was a fan of Bayern Leverkusen. And he was so shocked that I was a fan of football. And I got him at 9 o'clock at night. And I did not leave that room until 3 a.m. when literally the Israeli doctor who we have telemedicine and the wonderful Israeli doctor who his name is Dr. Sundy, who, Dr. Bernstein knows quite well, literally, the man had not had a heartbeat for several minutes. And this doctor is still asking me to try one more drug, one more thing, because we desperately wanted that man to live. And I have tears going down my face, and Dr. Sundy had tears running down his face. And we're trying to console each other, and I finally said, we have to stop. And I walked out that night. And I went home and I drank an entire fifth of whiskey. Ultimately, the drinking cost me my job. And when it did, well, let me back up. I knew I was in trouble. And I wanted to reach out and talk to Charlie, but I didn't have the courage. So when it was over, I was relieved because then I knew I could start getting help. And I did. I went to Journey Recovery Center and I went through a 5-day detox program, which, you know, because I had not been drinking for an extended period of time, that helped. It had not been years upon years, thank God. I never went through the big DTs and stuff that I had seen and everything. That helped. I did a 3-month, what we call IOP, which is intensive outpatient therapy. I did that. And it was wonderful. The problem was I fell through the cracks afterwards. I didn't get into a good therapy program afterwards. And I didn't have the right therapist, which is really, really important. And I didn't get into a good AA situation. And I should have. I never found a place that I fit. I didn't find a home group. I didn't find a place I felt welcome. So, you know, I had the Caduceus group and it was, that was really good, but I needed more and I didn't have more. So I screwed up a couple of times. In October, ultimately, I ended up getting a DUI. So at present, I am sitting here with an ankle monitor on. I am under home incarceration for 6 days. As my legal punishment for that, I have lost my driving privileges for 6 months and I had to pay $1,000 fine. And I have to do, oddly enough, a drug awareness program. It's not an alcohol awareness, it's a drug awareness. I'm not sure why that is, but a drug awareness program. Since then, I have found a really, really good supportive home group. I am attending AA meetings. Well, not this week. I can't leave my home. I have found a really supportive home group that has embraced me wonderfully and given great support. And just been there every step of the way. They spent a lot of time before my court date preparing me to go for the trial. And I know that they will be there with open arms as soon as I get this stupid thing off my ankle and be there for me when I go back and help me going forward. And that, I think, is very, very important. I think the way forward is there. I also have an excellent therapist now that I see weekly. I am able to see him through video visit, and I was able to visit yesterday. So I think this is wonderfully important that people know you can royally screw up, but you can go on. And I am presently 115 days sober. And, you know, I'm coming through it now. I don't know if I'm a cautionary tale or a work in progress. But I am getting to where I need to be. And I think that's my story, or at least the beginning chapters of the new story.